Everybody loves a lover. I'm a lover. Everybody loves me. Anyhow, that's how I feel. Wow, I feel just like a Pollyanna.
It occurred to me, I was running earlier today and I thought, John and I have known each other for a long time, but it's noteworthy that we're very good and affectionate friends for lifelong St. Louis Cardinals and Chicago Cubs fan.
True. I have supported your team supported my own team. I'm a fan. I'm just a fan in general.
And we support your team. And on that note, I'd like to welcome our dear listeners to another episode of your favorite podcast, In Bed with Nick and Megan, starring the luminous Nick Offerman.
Good evening.
Featuring his poor downtrodden bride, Megan Mullally. And today, extra super specially, guesting John Hamm. Hammy Hambones.
Hi, guys.
Hi, Johnny.
Quarantine podcast.
One of our favorite people.
Welcome to our dining room via our laptop.
Thank you. Welcome to my office via my laptop. You can see my mural in the background through the Venetian blinds, as well as featuring a bat signed by Stan Musial and a bass signed by Stan Musial in my little St. Louis Cardinals.
That's pretty homage. Badass.
That's impressive. And I would say that, I mean, I think I speak for everyone. One of the very worst parts of quarantine is not being able to get one of John Hamm's patented hugs.
Hamm hug.
Hamm hug, because they're really very medicinal.
I, like Nick Offerman, I'm a very tactile human, and we are very good at hugging, both your man and I. And when it combines, then it's a double excellent hug.
It really is.
It's solid, yeah.
It really is. I've been the lucky recipient of one or two of those, I think. You know what's so cool is that I didn't really realize how funny you are until you came in to do an episode of Children's Hospital. And I was like, oh, wait. Right. He's really funny.
Was that the one we did in one take?
Yes. And Malin Ackerman rips her face off and it's you. She's been you the whole time.
Which, by the way, kept coming back. I thought it was just going to be like a one-off thing, but it kind of kept referring to the fact that I'm in a Malin Ackerman mask the whole that's like canon for the series.
And I think you were just as yourself. She'd been John Hamm. Oh, no, you were Dr.
I was Derek Childrens.
Childrens, yeah.
Right.
Oh, my gosh.
It's so incredibly ridiculous. That show, by the way, kudos to you for being on it so many times, both of you, but was one of my favorite things to work on because David and the whole creative team on that thing, they didn't have a lot of money, they didn't have a lot of time, but they just solved all of their problems so creatively.
Yeah, that was such a fun show to do.
It was so ambitious. I mean, it's, you know, when they lost their set, then the whole thing was like, oh, now we're in Brazil or whatever. Yes. The thing that they kept having to say, like, because we're in Brazil. That's where we are.
Yeah,
in
so Brazil. It was David Wayne, Rob Corddry, and Jonathan Stern were the main, like, original producers. And I guess Rob Corddry created it, or maybe Rob and David, I don't know.
I think Rob did, because it was like it was like an online thing, wasn't it? Like in the early days of the internet. Well,
Corddry sent us those scripts when we were still in New York.
Yeah, so because I was actually a regular on it, strangely enough, and we did 7 seasons, and the first 2 seasons I think were just online, and then Adult Swim picked it up and we did it, and you know, like 11 minute episodes. So we would shoot 2 episodes a week. We would shoot about 14 episodes. So we'd just shoot for like 7 weeks and do the whole season. It was so fun.
It was so fun to be a part of. And like everybody top to bottom on that cast too. It's just so wildly funny and ambitious. And like proves the point of, you get talented people in the room, you get people that are funny, and you just let them go and give them a lot of leash. And it was, I don't know if you've been watching Medical Police. Did you, have you got, watch any of that? It's on Netflix now.
No, we haven't seen it yet.
Very similar in tone, but Hubel and Aaron are the main people. It's wildly funny.
Everybody's so good. Yeah. Rob Corddry, Rob Hubel, Ken Marino, Aaron Hayes, Lake Bell, Malin Ackerman.
Michael Cera is the voice of the...
Oh, yeah, Michael Cera. Oh, so good. So how did you originally know all those people?
I knew David, Wayne, Mike Black, and Mike Showalter from the Stella days. Like, that's when I first started meeting those guys. Oh, angle change.
Nice.
So I met them through Paul Rudd. I had watched them, all those guys, on The State when it was on MTV.
Ken Marino, he was in The State.
Mm-hmm. Ken, David, Joe Latrulio, Michael and Michael, Kerry Kinney, all these guys,
great people,
kind of came out of The State. And then when David, Michael and Michael were doing Stella, I was kind of bopping around New York and would catch those shows. They were very like hipster at the Fez or something, you know, downtown. And I was introduced to those guys through Paul Rudd, who I've known since I was a little young man back in the Midwest. So that's how I got to know those guys. And, you know, I was just plugging away, trying to get jobs. And I think I was working on like a Lifetime show at the time. Hmm. And then eventually, you know, David is so prolific that he would constantly have like weird little things to do. And, hey, do you want to do this? Do you want to do that? And I'm like, man, sure. I got nothing else better to do. Beats like my day job, which is like working on a procedural on Lifetime.
Yeah. Well, you're so funny. How many times have you hosted SNL?
I've hosted Saturday Night Live thrice.
Oh.
Three times. Actually, I think twice in the same calendar year. But I think three times in 2 years. So, yeah. So I was I hosted it three times, but I've been fortunate enough to be back and do some cold opens and some desk pieces and some other stuff. So
that's cool. Well, even though, you know, I've seen every episode of Mad Men and, you know, I think we've seen pretty much everything you've done in the last, I don't know, however many years, I just, because we know you, I don't really think of you as being particularly like a global sensation, you know, just because we know you. But we went to a baseball game with you at Dodger Stadium one time. It was Nick's birthday, actually, a couple of years
ago. Yeah, Cubs Dodgers, right?
Yeah. And I mean, that whole freaking stadium was about to explode over the fact that you were there.
That'll probably be one of the greatest like memories of my life, because we went for my birthday. And we were kissing. We were having a great time. Javi Baez.
Who was kissing, though, is what we need to establish.
You and I were kissing.
Because there's three people here right now.
We were having a nice kissing moment. Okay. And Javi cracks a home run while we're kissing. And we come out of it. The crowd's going crazy. And John Hamm says, "That was a fucking grand slam." And I was like, this is a great birthday. Such a great birthday.
That was
a very fun night, and thank you again for inviting me along. I'll happily be your third wheel.
But that was kind of interesting, because, you know, I hadn't really thought about it, but then I realized that, you know, you can't really get up and walk around at a baseball game because you'd get besieged, whereas we can, you know. It's a little bit different.
Yeah, you're a Christopher Reeves.
I want to talk about your career as a chick magnet, just because I want to understand how that is.
Now I'm
going
to have to ask you to clarify who you're talking to.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm talking to you, of course, my dear. But since John is here as our guest, I'll throw it to him too.
Okay, sure.
John, you first. so just like, I mean, it's got to get awkward sometimes when I'm sure that, I mean, I'm not talking about fans. I'm talking about just people that you know, or just any people you run into, or I mean, I'm sure that there are a lot of women who make overtures to you, and it's a burden, is what I'm gonna say.
Well, I'll say this: it's a weird thing when people are there, and I'm sure you both had versions of this, but people have this sense of entitlement and a sense of that they know you because they've seen you on their screens, or they've seen you for doing whatever TV show that they like, and they identify with it, and so therefore they feel like, oh, there's a connection that really isn't there, but it feels very real to them. And so then when the people see you in person, there's a lot of inappropriate social boundary crossing.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it's a very weird thing. And I don't think, I think the vast majority of that is unintentionally awkward. I don't think people are doing it to be terrible people. I think they're just overcome with whatever that thing is. And I've certainly had it too, of people, like, I remember the first time I got to meet Jeff Bridges. He had just won the Academy Award for True Grit. And he's been my favorite actor, I think, since I saw him in Last Picture Show. Like, I just, he was always my favorite guy. And I had that thing of, like, I was sort of thrust into a conversation with him. He's holding an Academy Award. And I couldn't put words together. Eventually I had to just say, like, I just wanted to say congratulations and thanks. And I had to walk away because I couldn't formulate the 400 things that I wanted to say all at once.
Yeah.
So I was literally,
but you
just
didn't,
like,
grab his dick. I mean, there's a difference.
I did not. I grabbed his Oscar and then ran away.
He is the best, though. And I totally know I've had that happen with a couple of, you know, a few people, actually. And it's a terrible feeling, but it does happen. And it's it's kind of beyond your control, you know? I mean, I met Stephen Sondheim once and I was rendered
speechless. Yeah, you can't say all the things that you want to say. And you realize, like, oh, that's that guy's deal every day. Like, how many people come up to Stephen Sondheim and are like, oh.
Yeah, I mean, how many people come up to Stephen and Sondheim and are just like, hey, oh, Stephen, you know, just are totally normal. Like, no,
exactly.
None.
By the way, did you see the Documentary Now episode that they did the Sondheim parody?
I don't think I saw that one. I saw a lot of
them. Do yourself a favor. It's, you know, they did that documentary years ago where they followed the cast of Company.
Oh. Yeah, with Elaine Stritch, yeah.
With Elaine Stritch, and so they do. Mulaney wrote this fictional musical called Co-op, and Richard Kine plays the doorman in the Co-op, and Paula Pell plays, like, the Elaine Stritch character.
Oh my god,
it's so funny.
You have to watch that. Yeah.
And so specific. And I was talking to somebody, I'm like, this is for such a hyper targeted audience of people that are either musical theater people or fans or whatever, but that have also seen that specific documentary and get all of the other things, and the rest of the world is like, what is this weirdness?
Yes, totally. You know, my very first audition for a television show was a show called The Ellen Burstyn Show, and I got it, which is insane. And this was in 1985, and it shot in New York. So we did 13 episodes, and Ellen Burstyn played my mother, and Elaine Stritch played my grandmother.
Whoa!
Yeah, so I got to work with her and Ellen, who's incredible, and Nick's actually gotten to work with Ellen too.
And Nick and I worked on the same movie with Ellen.
Oh, right.
That's right.
But Elaine and I got to be really good friends, and so I currently have two books. I have one autobiography of her, and then her another book that she wrote that I'm going to read, but I don't know. I just really, honestly, like, there are so few people like that who are truly one of a kind, who you just, they're impossible to describe to other people. And she was one of them. And
she knew Cole Porter.
Yeah, she like, she worked
who
with
knows
Cole Porter.
Cole Porter?
Like, yeah, she worked with with Noel Coward. I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, it's bonkers.
Brando and, but yes, a Brando tried to date her. But anyway, she was just so funny and amazing, and really the most exciting performer of music that I ever saw live. I mean, she was just electric. It was the, when she did her show Elaine Stritch at Liberty on Broadway. So that was probably 15 years ago. Yeah. It was so incredible. But Nick had never heard of Elaine. He didn't know anything about her. And so I wouldn't say I had to drag him there kicking and screaming, but I had to drag him there like,
that's a tough sell. I could see that.
Yeah, it was a little bit of a tough sell. And so there we are, and we're in house seats, and, you know, the lights go up, and Nick's kind of squirmy and heavily sighing and looking at his watch. And, I mean, she walked out on stage, you know, with that white shirt on and no pants.
Yeah.
And the heels. And Nick just sat bolt upright in his seat, and this big smile spread across his face and stayed there for the rest of the show. And he was a complete convert by the end. I mean, she was just
You can't not. I mean, she's so incredibly compelling and so fascinating. And her stories and her life and what she's gone through and her losses and all the other. You're just like, what a life.
Yeah. You know? And dear listener, if you watched 30 Rock and you're not familiar with who Elaine Stritch is, if you watched 30 Rock, she played Alec Baldwin's mother. She won an Emmy. I mean, she was on many episodes.
Deservedly so. She was very funny on 30 Rock.
Yeah, she was so great on that show.
Did you ever see the other one that's kind of like that, but with Carrie Fisher's one-woman show?
Yes.
We saw that live early on. The Geffen.
Yeah.
I saw it at the Geffen too. And now I'm thinking maybe we were at the same show, but I'm not
wishful
sure.
Because drinking. Oh, we might have been
drinking.
Backstage.
I was sat next to Mike Nichols.
Oh, no.
I was just like, what is going on?
Wow.
Like, this is
that's
crazy.
Incredible. That's wild. That's so cool. Well, wait a minute. I want to backtrack a little bit because Nikki Poo has a couple of good Jeff Bridges.
Ooh, yeah, hit me.
Boyfriend incidents.
Well, Nick and I worked on a movie with Jeff Bridges too.
Oh, yeah, Men Who Stare at Goats.
No, Bad Times at the El Royale.
Oh.
One of the, so John Hamm and I met in 1998, I believe, working on a film called The Early Bird Special, which I don't think ever came out.
I don't. If it did, it came out in a very, very limited way.
The executive producer and the director ended up in a squabble. And I think the executive producer came off as the bad guy. He didn't like the director's cut, but the director, a really nice guy named Mark Jean, he had final cut. And the executive producer was like, hey, I don't like your cut. Make these changes. And the director said, no, I have final cut. I'm leaving it. And the executive producer said, okay, then I'm putting it on the shelf in my closet.
Oh, Christ.
If you're going to be that way. And so the movie never came out. And all these people, you know, who did all this work. Yeah. But we met on that. John was cast in the role, I'll never forget it, of redheaded cop.
Red-headed cop.
It was no, I was not. Nor did I dye my hair. Nor was I asked to.
He's that good.
I'm that good. I was able to emote.
We believed red hair. Yeah.
The movie was written by a woman named Hilary Seitz, who went to college with my girlfriend at the time, my ex now, back at Yale many moons ago, and is now a very, very successful, famous screenwriter. But this was her first published, produced screenplay. And it was Nick, Max Perlick. I had one line in it. That's how I got my SAG card.
Wow.
And then cut to, I don't know, 8 years later, I think we saw each other again.
Yeah.
Something or other. And I was like, hey, I know you.
And for the record, I remember the scene that we shot was in Silver Lake at the Astro Family Restaurant, and I actually lived right up the hill from there, so it was all very momentous for me. And I met John, and we immediately hit it off as fellow Midwesterners. And I remember saying to him, just I stood back and looked at him and I said, why the fuck aren't you somewhere playing Superman?
Cut to
and he shrugged. I was like, yeah, I don't get it.
I asked myself that same question.
But so I lived right down the street too. I lived on Maltman and Sunset in Silver Lake in the old days when it was very different neighborhood than it is now.
I lived the basement that I was living in when I met Megan was
he was living in somebody's unfinished basement. Just had a dirt floor, so if he had to pee, just go over in the corner.
There was this great big old Craftsman like at the top of the first hill on Maltman up off Sunset, up the hill from Millie's.
Mm-hmm. That was the block I lived on.
It was an unfinished dirt basement.
Wait, you lived on that?
Well,
on that street?
Yeah, this married couple named Jason and Alicia, who ran the theater. They owned the building in which our theater company started, in which Megan and I, where we met in the year 2000.
I read your book.
So they were, putting us up. They were putting me up in their basement in exchange for like being a carpenter at the theater.
I think my friend Mike Uppendahl, who was a director on Mad Men, bought that house.
Oh wow, it's a beautiful house.
It is no longer unfinished, but I lived down the block, about halfway down the block from that house, on the other side of the street in a green and green 1919 Craftsman. Oh, wow. That was absolutely beautiful, but falling apart. But it was owned by a woman who at that point was in her late 80s and lived in Manhattan Plaza in New York. And this was her like family house that she grew up in. She was a soap opera actress on like The Guiding Light forever.
Oh, wow.
And so she would come into town 2 weeks out of the year, and me and three other guys lived in this house.
Crazy.
And it was the only affordable place I could find in LA. And then it turned out to be like, oh, it's like, this is where all the cool kids are. Like Silver Lake's where it's at. Like you go to the place? Spaceland and all the hipster restaurants and stuff. Millie's.
Yeah.
It was a tall cotton. To living in tall cotton was Silver Lake in the '90s.
I worked in this movie, The Men Who Stare at Goats, with Jeff, and I was basically, there was this platoon of psychic soldiers. It's based on...
I actually read that book. Yeah.
It's great. John
the book's
Ronson
amazing.
Book, yeah.
He's so good. John Ronson is the best.
And Clooney and Grant Heslov were making this film. Clooney was the lead. Grant was directing it. And Jeff played like the sort of guru general of the psychic soldiers. And they needed, 12 or 16 young privates. And me and one other guy got cast as like the guys who had like five lines each.
Yeah.
But you had to do all these different scenes because...
And you were around the whole run of the movie, but you only had five lines. That was
exactly.
My first movie too.
Mm-hmm. And for some reason, Jeff, I can't remember where he first took a shine to me. We were shooting a yoga scene on a roof in New Mexico. we shot around Roswell, and then we shot some stuff in Puerto Rico. And we were on a roof doing this yoga scene. And actually, no, we had had... There was one scene that was me, Jeff, Clooney, and Kevin Spacey. And I had this little bit where... I'm supposed to look at a box, a closed box, and say what's in it. It's like they're testing us for our psychic abilities. And I was wearing these like 80s, sort of plumber glasses. And I'm staring at this box. And then I took the glasses off and kind of slightly crossed my eyes. And then I was able to see what was in the box. And from that day, Jeff took some kind of shine to me. So we were doing this yoga scene on a roof. And he had his iPod. This is early aughts, and he had his headphones. And he said, "Hey, Nick, do you know Eckhart Tolle?" And I was like, "Thanks to Megan, I did." And I was like, "Yeah, New Earth, or what's the other one? The power of
power
now.
Now.
Power of
New
now.
Earth or power of now?" And he's like, "Oh, power now, man." And he gives me one of the buds. and they're still wired. You know, this is
yeah.
long ago enough. So I'm standing there sharing earbuds with fucking Jeff, listening to Eckhart Tolle and Clooney. And we're, you know, everybody's running around. Like we're getting ready to shoot this yoga scene with like 18, 20 people in it. And George, you know, George is the producer of the movie. And he's also the lead, so he can't be as much of a smartass as usual. And right. so he was demonstrably producing, where he's like, okay, guys, come on. You know, he was team captaining very right. successfully. And I'm totally this freshman actor standing there with Jeff, and Clooney's like, all right, guys, come on, ready to go, ready to roll. And everybody's in place except me and Jeff are standing there
listening to
the two kids at the back of the bus. And I'm so torn because I'm always the good student. Like I'm always right. the one who wants to make the AD's life easier. And it almost broke me. But finally, Jeff was like, okay, man, we can listen to this later. So I don't understand why, but we became friendly and then.
Yeah, it's weird because nobody else likes you.
I know.
I know. I can't make heads or tails of it. It's uncanny.
But then, I mean, the thing was, you know, then several years went by, and then I got Drew Goddard, who wrote and directed Bad Times at the El Royale, got a hold of me. He also co-created The Good Place, so I knew him from the circle of Mike Schur. And he basically called and said, do you want to come play Jeff Bridges' brother for 3 days in you know, British Columbia? And it's a little part. In fact, many people don't even realize it's me in the movie. It's not the kind of
mask.
Yeah. You don't take the part. It's not the kind of part you take for the part. It's the kind of part you take to spend a week with Jeff Bridges in British Columbia. And very gratifyingly, he remembered me. You know, I was like, do I have to start over from scratch? But no,
he knows he's a
beautiful,
solid,
beautiful soul
guy when he meets one.
That was one of those, you know, meet your heroes moments where you're the opposite of what everyone says happens. You're just like, oh, this is a truly nice, gentle man.
Yeah.
And he'll talk to you about stuff, and it's not just like lip service, and he wants to hear your opinion on this, that. What kind of music are you listening to, man? Okay, cool. All right, I'm feeling a little tired. I'm going to go take a nap. All right. Like, cool, man. Take a nap. You're Jeff Bridges.
Do it. Take as long as you want. Who are some of your favorite, or do you have like favorite actors you've worked with, or, you know?
Well, you know, as you and Nick can both probably attest to, when you're on a show for a long time, you obviously develop incredibly close relationships with all of those people. So like Slattery in particular, John Slattery and I are thick as thieves and fast friends. And
yeah, you guys are so great together.
Yeah. I mean, it was such a, you know, it was a long time. It was the better part of a decade. I think 9 years we shot that show. And so you naturally develop like closeness and relationships, and then you get to see people do their thing, whether it's January or Lizzie or Christina or Vincent, like all those guys, and we're all kind of still bonded by that experience.
How old were you, and how did you come to meet Paul Rudd while you're still in the Midwest?
I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, and Paul spent the majority of his growing up in just outside of Kansas City, Missouri. I think he is in like Overland Park or Olathe, one of the Kansas suburbs of Kansas City, Missouri. And he is a couple years older than me, believe it or not, and graduated high school, went to KU in Lawrence, Kansas. At the same time, a girl who I used to date in high school and then became very good family friends with them. The older brother of that family also went to Kansas University in Lawrence, Kansas, where he was randomly assigned a roommate named Paul Rudd. So Paul would come home with my friend Preston for Thanksgiving, for whatever holiday, for long weekends to like hang out in St. Louis. And I would be over at the house because I was dating the girl or whatever, just like it was something to do, and we'd play like Trivial Pursuit, and like, so it was just something that was her older brother's friend from college.
How crazy.
And so, yeah, and that was when I was 17 or 18 years old, 17, I think, because they would have been freshmen. And yeah, it was funny. I was talking with Paul the other day. We were on a Zoom, and, you know, it's like, we've known each other for 40 years. No, 30 some odd years. Like, it's just crazy.
It is.
And you go, okay. And we would talk about these, like when I first moved to LA, he was the only person I knew in LA. He, by that time, had, dropped out of KU and gone to study acting at the place up in Pasadena, Academy of Dramatic Arts or whatever it's called. And he had lived out here for some time, and I came out and visited him. And at that point, our mutual friend Preston had moved out here, and he was working for some, wanted to be a musician, but he was working for some like consulting company. And I came out on my spring break from Mizzou, and I came out to visit them, see like, cause I had an acting, a theater scholarship by that point. So I came out and was like, well, I'm going to test the water and see what it's like. And was, of course, completely overwhelmed by how huge LA is and like crazy and expensive and everything else. But that was the first time I came out and met those guys that were living in some shitbox in North Hollywood that like, I don't even think survived the earthquake a few years later. But when I came out here in 1995, Paul was literally the only, one of the only people I knew, especially in the business.
How
and so
crazy.
I was like, dude, I hate being this guy, but you're the only person I know. And I'll only ask you one time. Like, I just need one phone number of a person that can possibly help me. And that's all I'll ask. I won't be, you know, up your butt about it. But, and he gave me the phone number of his manager, and his manager introduced me to some people at William Morris. And then,
and here we are
a short 4 years later, I got my first job.
Oh my God.
And now you're on
in Dodger Stadium.
Now you're in bed with Nick and Megan.
Oh, baby.
The pinnacle.
If I would have known then what I know now.
I love that shit. There's this weird, maybe it's because they do this great benefit for charity every year called the Big Slick in Kansas City. There's Paul Rudd, Eric Stone Street, Rob Riggle, Sudeikis,
all the KC boys,
and Koechner. Dave Koechner.
Oh wow!
And they get people together, and they do, and it's all this great charity for like the Children's Hospital there.
Children's Hospital, yeah.
And when I was doing a movie called We're the Millers with Sudeikis, he was telling me about when he was in like high school. Dan Harmon was part of a touring comedy group, I think out of Chicago, like just a weird improv like road tour.
Uh-huh.
And it was when improv was catching on, and so the collegiate age theater people were doing what were called like comedy sports.
Right.
And it became this thing where like, so Harmon was like a national champion, and so he became this touring pro comedy freak. So Jason was very inspired to go into that art form by seeing Dan Harmon on the road. And for those that don't know, Dan Harmon created Community and Rick and Morty. He's a comedy genius. I love that. I love those origin stories that predate even.
Well, I remember when I read your book, like it's so funny because we all obviously come from someplace. Those of us who aren't fortunate enough to be born into it or have a famous dad or uncle or what have you, but you know, there's a lot of roads to get to the destination, and when I talk to friends of mine from home, they're just, it's like when I moved to LA, it was like I moved to the moon. They were just like, what, how are you even in Los Angeles? I'm like, it's a city, it's a town, I have a car and a place and a thing, and there's stores and banks and like, it's just normal.
You can
it's
get food, big. All that shit.
Yeah, they have Mexican food and McDonald's and everything. It's like,
got it all.
But I do remember driving into LA for the first time and thinking like, this city doesn't stop. Yeah. Like, I think I was in like West Covina or something, and then I just didn't see any more trees until I hit like Santa Monica. I was like, what is going on?
It's gigantic.
It's so big. And
it's gigantic.
You guys,
and it's not on a grid. So you,
I'm sure you remember like the old school Thomas guide.
Oh yeah.
Oh,
but
yes.
Like before the era of GPS and cell phones and everything, there was a map and it was a bound, you know, chunk of paper with a spiral binder that you kept in your car in case you got lost.
Every, you know, coordinate in the city.
And I just remember my aunt giving me that, like, here's your map. And I was like, oh, I'm never going to understand the city. And of course, as you grow up and you realize, you're like, oh, you only need like 3 pages of that map. Like, it's the same 3 pages that you're always on. But you could fully like burn 2/3 of it and be fine. It's one of those things, like, it's so overwhelming. I think I remember some portion of your book, Nick, but like talking about just putting one foot in front of the other and just kind of keep on keeping on. And then all of a sudden, you told a story about when you got Parks and Rec, and I remember when I got, the first thing I got, I think a TV show called Providence, which was on NBC on Friday nights. And I just remember thinking like, oh, like sometimes they say yes.
Yeah.
That's, you know, such may a good feeling.
May I say you're so good about reading people's books.
I love, especially people that I know, and you guys were kind enough to send me copies too, but I love reading my friends' books, like, because it's one of those fun things where you're like, oh, you think you know somebody fairly well, and then you read their book, you're like, I had no idea about any of that. That's wildly interesting. Like, Polar's was great, Tina's was great. I just read Jenny Slate's most recent collection of little,
so good.
Little short weird. Stories, like, yeah. It's great. I mean, I've known she was a really good writer for a long time, but like her dad's a poet.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's always fun to like, and I have no capacity to write anything much longer than a text or an email. I just get frazzled and I lose my place. But I love that.
Oh, you don't write at all?
No.
It's funny though, because you've told me stories over the years. And one thing, whenever I think about, like, I'm starting another book shortly, and I'm always aware of my strengths and weaknesses. And I think one of my weaknesses is I don't have great recall. I don't have that great writer's eye for detail. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I'm glad that I'm aware of that. So I don't, I don't try to, turn in my novel anytime soon, but something I always think about with you is you've told me stories, even like standing around at a party where we've had a few cocktails, and you, with complete acuity, you're like, let me tell you something. It's 1977. And you lay out this anecdote with all of these great details. And I always comment and say, how do you retain that stuff?
That's such a great
half of it's made up. I'll be honest.
Well, I would argue if you ever wanted to, I think you could write a great, you could see your way into it, like a book of just essays of sporting events that you've experienced. I think you could write that
I have been incredibly lucky. Like those are the kinds of things like in my life that I look back and say, like, I've gotten so many opportunities even before I was in showbiz. But like when I was a little kid, my dad, the Cardinals made it to the World Series for the first time in my recollection in my lifetime in 1982. And interestingly enough, they just showed the replay of that World Series, which I hadn't seen since I saw it in 1982, because they don't replay those things for obvious reasons. But I was 11 years old, and the Cardinals had always been bad. Like, they just were never that good. And then 82 was the first year, like, wait, we're in first place in a thing ever? What is that about? And I always watched the World Series, and it was always like the Yankees or the Dodgers or the, you know, the Angels or the A's, like whatever the big teams were in the 70s. And it was, the World Series was always a thing that happened to other places. And St. Louis was this small town. And then that year they went to the World Series. And I was like, we're in the World Series. Like, oh my God, my head exploded. And I never, ever thought I would get a chance to go to the World Series. Like, that was, I was happy to watch it on NBC. That's going to be great. Then, you know, Joe Garagiola will be calling it. That's all I need. And then I remember one day my dad said, I want to talk to you. Come into the bedroom for a second. I need to talk to you. And I was like, okay. Never a good sign. And he pulled it back, the cover on the bed, and there were tickets to all the games of the World Series, like 4 tickets to each game of the home game of the World Series. Like, in that printed out block, you know, like how they used to be connected to each other.
Was your dad Keith Hernandez?
He knew somebody. My dad was pretty connected in St. Louis. My dad and my grandfather and my great-grandfather had a trucking company. Anyway, he had a lot of connections in town, and I guess he pulled some strings and got some tickets. And I went to the first game, which we lost 10-1 or something like that. And it was heartbreaking. And then over the course of the series, it ended up going to 7 games, and I went to the 7th game, which we won in comeback fashion. And I just remember being an 11-year-old kid and not knowing what to do with my body. Like, just Kool and the Gang's Celebration was the theme song. It was on every radio station 24 hours a day. And people were singing in the streets. And I don't think I've ever been happier.
How are you doing this year with no baseball and no sports?
I mean, it's weird. It is what it is. Again, here we are. It's just a new normal for now. And weirdly enough, I'm like friends with some ex ball players and hockey players and ex hockey players. And I'm like, what are you doing? Like, all those guys do is their sport, and their window for performance is so narrow. And to like lose a whole year of that is devastating, you know?
Yeah.
And you just, you know, everybody's got a story of how this particular insanity has affected them, and no one's is any better or any worse. Mm-hmm. They're all super difficult, but you know, again, I wake up every day and I'm just thankful that, you know, I have a house and a, you know, a place to stay, and the people that I care about are taken care of. And you know, it's easy enough to lose sight of that, but then I get to talk to like cool friends like you guys.
Oh, Johnny Hambones. You really are the best. Does anybody else call you Johnny Hambones, or is it just me?
I think it's just you.
Okay. Do you hate it?
No, I love it.
Okay, good. Because I'm not stopping. Well, it has been so lovely to have you on the podcast.
This is the right way to start a week, because from here, I got a whole week to think about you guys and catch up on some more of your books.
That's so sweet. You're so nice. Everybody, please savor this precious episode with John Hamm. And
I'll tell you what, John, you can, I think I can speak for both of us when I say you can haul our loads up the levee any day of the week.
I concur. Thank you, dear listener, for listening to yet another episode of In Bed with Nick and Megan, featuring the very, very sweet and kind John Hamm. Good night.
Good night.
Yes, you might call me a Pollyanna.
In Bed with Nick and Megan is an Earwolf production. It's produced by Megan Mullally, Kevin Bartelt, and Michael Landry. Executive produced by Colin Anderson and Chris Bannon. Music by Nancy and Beth, which can be found at www.nancyandbeth.com. If you enjoyed In Bed with Nick and Megan, make sure to rate it and review the show on Apple Podcasts.